wandering on the hard shoulder of the A64, and police are trying to trace her whereabouts through CCTV. The woman, who has not been named, is a resident of Poplar Hill Care Home. A spokesperson for the care home said a full investigation is underway as to how the woman had been able to get out of a secure ward and declined to comment further. Viola was in Changi Airport by then, another fugitive. She took a taxi from King's Cross to the Mandarin Oriental in Knightsbridge. She had suggested to Bertie that they meet up while she was in town.
Dinner? At dinner.
The Heston Blumenthal place at the Mandarin. Talk about calling a spade.
My treat.
Can't, sorry, Bertie said. I'm busy.
Too busy for your own mother?
Viola said lightly. Sow and reap. The horror of Saturday night came surging back. Gregory said she had abandonment issues.
As in you abandoned us, Bertie said.
She felt sick. Give Viola three wishes, and what would she ask for? Her children back as babies. Her children back as babies. Her children back as babies. Somewhere high over the Indian Ocean, she remembered the powerful dream from last night. She was in a train station, not a modern one. It felt like the past, dark and sooty. Sonny was with her, 5 or 6 years old, wearing that funny little red duffel coat he'd had, a stripy scarf around his neck. Yes, she had dressed him badly, she admitted it, all right. The station was busy. People were rushing to catch the train, to get home. They were impeded by a turnstile and a ticket collector in a booth. There were steps that led down to the platform and the train, which were both out of sight. It was Viola and Sonny's job to help the people catch the train, herding them like sheepdogs and shouting encouragement at them. And then the rush slowed to a trickle and finally stopped. They could hear the last of the train's doors slam down below, and the guard blew his whistle, and Sonny turned to her and with a beaming grin on his face said,
"We did it, Mum. Everyone got on the train."
Viola had absolutely no idea what the dream meant.
"Are you all right, Mrs. Romaine?"
the lovely Asian flight attendant was asking her. They were all lovely to you in first class. Viola supposed that was what you paid for. Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
"Sad film," she said,
indicating her blank TV screen.
"Do you think I could have a cup of tea?"
She negotiated passport control and baggage retrieval and walked towards the exit, pulling her suitcase behind her. The automatic doors to the arrivals hall swished quietly open. There was a driver on the other side of the barrier, holding up a sign with her name on it. He would take her to a very nice hotel, and then tomorrow or the next day, she seemed to have lost her schedule, she would do a Meet the Author event and give a reading, a little preview from her new book, Every Third Thought, out next month. She seemed to recall she was also down for a couple of panel events as well. The Role of the Writer in the Contemporary World. Popular versus Literary. A False Divide. Something like that. It was always something like that. Literary festivals, bookshops, interviews, online chats. You were just filling up other people's empty spaces, really. But they were filling up your empty spaces, too. She approached the driver. He would have no idea who she was unless she identified herself. She swerved away from him, carried on as if that was her intention all along, took the escalator back up to the check-in area, found the Singapore Airlines ticketing desk, and bought a ticket to Denpasar. She imagined the look on Sunny's face.
Surprise, surprise.
They would get everyone on the train, somehow or other. 30th of March, 1944. The last flight. The fall. He had just whistled for the dog when he spotted a pair of hares in the grassy field that lay on the western side of the farmhouse. March hares, boxing like bare-knuckle fighters, the spring madness upon them. He caught sight of a third hare, then a fourth. Once, when he was a boy, He had counted 7 at one time, in the meadow at Fox Corner. The meadow had gone now, Pamela reported, ploughed up for winter wheat for hungry wartime mouths. The flax and larkspur, buttercups, corn poppies, red campion, the oxeye daisies, all gone, never to come back. The hares might be convinced by the new season, but it didn't feel much like spring yet to Teddy. Pale clouds scudded across a washed-out sky. They were driven by a sharp east wind that was blowing all the way from the North Sea across the flat landscape, whipping soil off the dry tops of the bare furrows. It was the kind of weather that lowered the spirits, although Teddy's were lifted a little by the sight of the jousting hares and the high, fluty notes of a blackbird answering his own whistle from somewhere unseen. The dog heard his whistle too. Lucky always heard him whistle, and was making a headlong dash in his direction, blithely unaware of the hare's sparring match taking place in the field. The dog roamed far and wide these days, quite at home in the countryside, although equally at home, apparently, in the waffery. When the dog reached him, it sat promptly, gazing up at his face, waiting for its next orders.
"Let's go," Teddy said. "We're on ops tonight. Me," he added, "not you."
Once was enough. When he looked again, the hares had disappeared. The orders had come down from Bomber Command HQ at High Wycombe this morning, but only a small handful of people on the station, Teddy one of them, was ever given early notice of the target. As a wing commander, he was discouraged from flying too frequently, or we'd be losing a wing commander a week, as the CO put it. All pre-war notions of hierarchy in the RAF had long since been upended. You could be a wing commander at 23, dead at 24. He was on his third tour. There had been no obligation to sign up for it. He could have returned to instructing. He could have requested a desk job. "It was madness," Sylvie wrote. He tended to agree with her. He had flown now on over 70 raids, and had come to be regarded as untouchable by many on the squadron. This was how myths were made these days, Teddy thought, simply by staying alive longer than anyone else. Perhaps that was his role now, to be the juju, to be the magic, to keep as many safe as possible. Perhaps he was immortal. He tested this theory by getting himself on the battle order as often as possible, despite protests from higher up. He was back with the first squadron he had served with, but now they were to be found not on the comfortable brick-built pre-war RAF base that had housed them near the beginning of the war, but in a hastily erected township, commandeered from corrugated iron and mud. It would only take a few years after they left, for leave they surely would, even the Hundred Years' War had come to an end, for it to return to fields, to the brown, the green and the gold. If he went on a sortie, he flew in F. Fox. She was a good, sound aircraft that had already beaten the odds by carrying one crew safely through their tour, but really he just liked the name and its associations with home. Ursula reported that Sylvie, who once upon a time loved the foxes at Fox Corner, had been laying poison down for them after they had committed a particularly successful raid on the hen house. "She might come back as a fox in the next life," Ursula wrote, "and then she'll be very sorry." She liked the idea of reincarnation, his sister said, but of course she couldn't actually believe in it. That was the trouble with faith, Teddy thought. By its very nature, it was impossible. He didn't believe in anything anymore. Trees, perhaps. Trees and rocks and water. The rising of the sun and the running of the deer. He mourned for the foxes. He would have placed them above a coop of chickens in the order of things. Above many people, too. He had sidestepped Christmas at Fox Corner, saying that he had to remain on the station, which was only half a lie. And he had not seen their potentially vulpine mother for many months. Not, in fact, since the irritating lunch at Fox Corner after Hamburg. He realized that he had ceased to have any affection for Sylvie. "One does," Ursula said. F-Fox's ground crew always issued dire warnings to anyone who had been allowed to borrow her. Bring the Winko's kite back safely or else. Although really, as far as the ground crew were concerned, the aircraft belonged to them, and they admonished Teddy himself in much the same terms. Sometimes Teddy went up in one of the ropier old kites to test further his theory of immortality. His regular ground crew were unhappy if he flew with the new, the untested and the shaky. He occasionally piloted a Sprog crew, but usually he took the dicky seat and flew as a reassuring second pilot with them. It wasn't unlucky if he was in it. Quite the opposite. "We'll be safe now the Winko's with us," he heard them say. He remembered Keith and his Widdershins luck that had let him down in the end. He made his way out to the dispersal pan to visit F. Fox and her ground crew. It was the first flight for the crew Teddy was going up with. They had been delivered fresh out of the box from the OTU at Rufforth that morning. They had been assigned their own aircraft, but the ground crew had declared her unserviceable after her air test, and Teddy had offered F. Fox to them, along with himself. They were as cheerful and excited as puppies at the prospect. A Bowser was already feeding fuel into F. Fox's wing tanks. The ground crew knew roughly where they would be going by the amount being taken on board, but never talked about the target to the air crew. They kept everything close to themselves. Perhaps they thought it was bad luck. Some of them would be keeping a long vigil through the night, usually huddled around an inadequate stove in their bleak little hut at dispersal, snoozing fitfully on a camp bed, or even sitting on an upturned toolbox, waiting anxiously for F. Fox's return. Waiting for Teddy. A trolley of bombs trundled towards the aircraft, a miniature train, and the armourers started winching the bombs into the bomb bay. Someone had chalked on one of the bombs, "This is for Ernie, Adolf." And Teddy wondered who Ernie was, but didn't ask, and no one said. One of the Irks, a cheerful Liverpudlian, was at the top of a ladder, preoccupied with polishing the perspex on the rear turret with a pair of blackouts, the large, serviceable knickers that the WAFs wore. He had discovered, perhaps it was best not to imagine how, that they were the best material for this vital job. A little speck of dirt on the perspex could be mistaken by the gunner for a German fighter, and before you knew it, he'd be shooting his guns off all over the sky, betraying their position to the enemy. The Irk caught sight of Teddy and said, "Everything okay, Skip?" Teddy answered with a breezy affirmative. Calm confidence, that was the best demeanour for a captain. Pull everyone along behind you in your optimistic wake. And try and learn everyone's names. And be kind, because why not? He had made a vow, a private promise to the world in the long dark watches of the night, that if he did survive, then in the great afterward, he would always try to be kind, to live a good, quiet life. Like Candide, he would cultivate his garden, quietly, and that would be his redemption. Even if he could add only a feather to the balance, it would be some kind of repayment for being spared. When it was all over, and the reckoning fell due, it may be that he would be in need of that feather. He knew that he was just stooging around, doing nothing useful. These fits of restlessness, mental and physical, seemed to be increasing all the time. Sometimes he found himself drifting off, lost not so much in thought as no thought at all, and without realizing it, he found himself now at the pigeon loft. The homing pigeons were kept in a shed behind the crew's Nissen hut sleeping quarters, and were looked after by one of the cooks, who was a pigeon fancier and missed his own racing birds back in Dewsbury. Teddy made the dogs stay outside the shed. It always barked at the birds and set them fluttering nervously, even though they were generally by their nature a steadfast, even heroic sort of creature. The theory was that the pigeons on board an aircraft could be used to relay messages, and that in the event of ditching or parachuting out, you could write your location down and put it in a little canister, and the bird would carry this precious information home. It seemed to Teddy, however, that it was highly unlikely that if you were trying to evade in enemy territory, Anyone would find you because of some incoherent scribble. You would have to know where you were, for a start, and the bird would have to overcome tremendous odds just to make it back to British shores. He wondered if the girl from the Air Ministry had any figures for that. The Germans kept hawks along the French coast, solely for the purpose of bringing the poor birds down. And, of course, you would have to remember to get a bird out of the basket that was stowed in the fuselage and stuff it into a container that was not much bigger than a vacuum flask, a tricky feat in itself. Bailing out of a crippled bomber involved, at best, a mad life-or-death scramble to clip on parachutes, throw off escape hatches, help the wounded out, while all the time the aircraft was on fire or in an uncontrollable dive. The poor pigeons would not be uppermost in anyone's mind in those last few desperate seconds. He wondered how many of them had been left behind, helplessly trapped in their baskets, abandoned to burn or drown, or simply disintegrate in a little cloud of feathers when an aircraft exploded. Everyone knew not to put the pigeons on the Winco's kite. Teddy was soothed by the soft cooing and the earthy ammoniac smell of the dim shed. He took one of the compliant birds from its hatch and stroked it gently. It suffered his attentions without protest. When he put it back, it eyed him steadily, and he wondered what it was thinking. Not much, he supposed. When he came back outside, into the harsh daylight, the dog sniffed him suspiciously for signs of infidelity. It was lunchtime and he set off for the mess. He had little appetite these days, but he forced the food down in a dutiful fashion. There was a particularly stodgy kind of steamed sponge pudding containing prunes that translated as plum duff on the blackboard menu and which sat heavily in his stomach afterwards. He remembered with pleasure something called a far breton that he had eaten beneath a hot French sun. The French could transform even prunes into something delicious. He had made an emergency landing at Elvington, where the French crews were stationed, and discovered that their cooks were also French, and they treated their rations with a good deal more elan than the RAF canteen staff. And what's more, they took their meals with a glass of red wine. Algerian, but wine nonetheless. They would not have tolerated a plum duff. The crews had spent the rest of the afternoon resting, writing letters, playing darts, listening to the wireless in the mess, always tuned to the BBC Forces programme. Some slept. A lot of them had been on ops last night, and had not fallen into their beds until well after first light. Meanwhile, the target was being revealed to the pilots and navigators in a preliminary briefing. There were specialist briefings for the wireless operators and bomb aimers. Teddy more than half expected the op to be scrubbed. They were into the moon period, and the skies were clear, but soon, with the shorter nights of spring, it would be impossible to fly the long raids deep into Germany. He supposed that this was Harris's last hurrah in the Battle of Berlin. The long, grueling series of winter raids with their high toll was nearly over. 78 bombers lost to Leipzig last month, 73 to Berlin last week. Nearly 1,000 crew lost since November, every one a young man. Flowers of the Forest, the lament played at the funeral of a Canadian navigator that Teddy and Mac both knew on their first tour. Walter. Walt. His nickname was Disney. Teddy didn't think that he'd ever known his real name, although he must surely have had one. It seems so long ago now, and yet it wasn't. The CO had asked them to accompany Disney's body to Stonefall and act as pallbearers. A Scots piper had been found in Leeds and played at the graveside. Disney had been killed by flak on a raid over Bremen. The flight engineer navigator had used astro-navigation to get them home, unable to consult Disney's maps and charts because they were so sodden with his blood that they were useless. They were burning burnt-out towns, bombing bombed-out cities. It had been a good idea. Defeat them in the air and save the world from the horror of land warfare, from Ypres, the Somme, Passchendaele. But it wasn't working. When they were not down, they got up again, the stuff of nightmares, an endless harvest of dragon's teeth sprouting on the plain of Ares. And so they continued throwing the birds against the wall, and still the wall stood. An air vice marshal had dropped in on the squadron. He had lots of medals and braid, scrambled egg, on display.
"Like to show my face to the men," he said.
Teddy didn't remember ever seeing his face before. His mind was on Nancy. He had received a letter that morning. Many words, as usual, yet saying nothing, also as usual. But at the end, a reference to their engagement, and how she would understand if your feelings have changed. "You write to me so rarely, darling." Was she really saying that her feelings had changed? His CO said,
"Ted, ready?"
disrupting his wool gathering, and they made their way to the briefing hut, the vice marshal striding authoritatively ahead. He was accompanied by his rather glamorous WAF driver, who surprised Teddy by winking at him. The crews were already assembled, ticked off on a roll at the door by the RAF police. Once everyone was in, the doors would be locked and the windows shuttered. The air vice marshal's driver was left to kick her heels outside. Security was tight before a raid. No one could leave the station or make phone calls. Keeping the target secret was vital, although it was often jokingly said that if you wanted to know the next target, you only need to go to Betty's bar. The reality was that one way or another, the Germans were tracking them from the moment they took off. They listened on their radio frequencies, jammed the G, tracked the HS2, and caught them in the net of their own radar that stretched along the coast of Europe. Toe to toe, blow for blow. When they entered the briefing hut, there was a great clattering of chairs as the crews, some 120 of them, stood to attention. The room, a Nissen hut, was the usual smoky, sweaty fog. More scraping and bumping of chairs as everyone sat down again. The map on the wall was hidden by a blackout curtain, and the CO always drew it back with a theatrical flourish, as if it was part of a conjuring trick, before pronouncing the by now time-honoured words,
"Gentlemen, your target for tonight is..."
Nuremberg.
There was a rumble of discontent from the more experienced crews, a few Jesuses and Christs, an Australian Struth, despite the presence of the scrambled egg. It was a long flight, deep into the enemy's heartland, nearly three times further than going to the Ruhr. The red ribbon stretched almost straight to the target with hardly any of the usual zigzagging. The senior intelligence officer, a stern-faced WAF, who took her duties very seriously, stood up and told them all about the importance of the target. It was 7 long months since it had been attacked, and was largely intact, despite being home to a huge SS barracks as well as the famous Mann armament works. And now that the Siemens factory in Berlin had been bombed, they had stepped up production of searchlights, electric motors, and so on, at their Nuremberg works. The city was symbolic, where Hitler held his mass rallies, and was close to the enemy's heart, the intelligence officer continued. It would hit their morale hard. The aiming point was the railway yards, but the creep back would find the medieval city, the Altstadt, she said, making a poor stab at German pronunciation. They were carrying high loads of incendiaries, and the old wooden buildings would burn well. Dürer's birthplace was in the Altstadt. Teddy had grown up with two of Dürer's prints. They had hung in the morning room at Fox Corner, one of a hare and one of a pair of red squirrels. The intelligence officer didn't mention Dürer. She was more interested in the flak and searchlight positions that were marked on the map with green and red celluloid overlays. The crews, too, paid careful attention to them, their unease growing all the time as they looked at the long, straight red ribbon. But it was the moon that was really upsetting them, upsetting Teddy, too. It was an unusually bright half-moon, and it was going to be shining down on them like a bright coin through a long, dark night. Their unhappiness was compounded when they were told they were to fly through the Cologne Gap. It was unlikely to be heavily defended this late in the year, they were told. Really, Teddy thought. The route passed close to the Ruhr and Frankfurt defences, to night fighter airfields and their beacons, Ida and Otto, around which the German fighters circled, waiting like hawks after pigeons. The Met officer took the stage and gave details of wind speeds, cloud conditions, and the weather likely to be encountered. He said there was a possibility of fairly good cloud cover on the way there and back that might hide them from the fighters. The word possibility made them shift nervously in their seats. The word might made it worse. Fairly wasn't too promising either. It would be clear over the target, he said, even though the first pathfinders had already reported cumulus at 8,000 feet, information that wasn't passed on to the crews. They needed it to be the other way round. Cloud on that long leg to hide them from the fighters, and the moon illuminating their target. The CO had confided in Teddy that he was certain the op would be scrubbed. Teddy didn't know why it had been considered in the first place. Churchill liked the target. Harris liked the target. Teddy didn't. He didn't suppose Harris and Churchill cared much for his opinion. The specialist leaders made a few pertinent remarks. The navigators were taken over the route and the turning points. The sparks were reminded of their frequencies for the night. The bombing leaders detailed the payload and ratio of high explosive to incendiaries and the timing and phasing of attacks, the colours of the target indicators that they were to drop their bombs on. Everyone was reminded of the colours of the day. They all knew of crews shot down by friendly fire for shooting off the wrong colours of the day. Then Teddy was up. A constant course of 265 miles over well-defended enemy territory in bright moonlight with little chance of cloud cover. For the sake of morale, the quietly confident leader, he tried to spin these bleak facts into something less dire, highlighting again the importance of the city as an industrial and transport center, the blow to enemy morale, and so on. The long leg will suggest a number of other possible targets to the fighters, so they will be distracted from the Cologne Gap. The sheer simplicity of the long leg will fool them, and the lack of dog legs will conserve fuel, and that means that you can carry heavier bomb loads. And being more direct, it will mean less fatigue for you. You will get there quicker, and the quicker you get there, the quicker you will get safely back here. And keep a tight bomber stream, always. He sat down again. They trusted him. He could see it on their haggard faces. There was no going back for them now, so it was best that they went out in a good frame of mind. There was nothing worse than setting out oppressed by the feeling that you were for the chop. He remembered Duisburg, the last op of his first tour, how his crew had been jittery, convinced they were going for a Burton. Two of them had, of course, George and Vic. Of J-Jig's original crew, there was only himself and Mac left. He had a letter from Mac, telling him that he had got married, honeymooned at Niagara, little one on the way. The war was over for Mac. Kenny had gone on to train new air gunners at a gunnery school and had written a letter to Teddy in his almost illiterate hand.
Me, an instructor, who'd have thought it?
A few weeks later, he was in an aircraft that crash-landed on return from a cross-country training exercise. Three crew members survived. Kenny wasn't one of them. One of his many sisters wrote to Teddy,
"Wee Kenny is an angel now,"
in a hand almost as poor as Kenny's. If only that were true, Teddy thought. If only the ranks of Spencer's bright squadrons were being swelled by those of Bomber Command. But they weren't. The dead were dead. And they were legion. Kenny should have kept his mangy black cat, instead of giving it to Vic Bennett's baby. A letter had wound its way to him eventually, not from Lil, but from Mrs. Bennett, a reluctantly proud new grandmother.
A girl. Not much to look at, but she'll do.
A Margaret, not an Edward. And Teddy was relieved that he didn't have a namesake.
Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving?
The CO gave a few encouraging words. The Vice Marshal made some hearty remarks, as befitted someone sporting so much scrambled egg. A medic, standing at the door, handed out wakey-wakey pills as they went past. And that was that. There was the traditional Last Supper, Not much of a feast tonight. Sausages and a rubbery egg. No bacon. Teddy thought of Sylvie's pig, of the smell of roasting pork. They were sealed off now. A bad time when your thoughts could overshadow everything. Teddy had a few games of dominoes with a flight lieutenant in the officer's mess. It was mindless enough to satisfy both of them, but it was a relief when it was time to go to the crew room and get kitted up. Thick woolen long johns and vest, knee-length socks, roll-neck pullover shirt, battle dress, sheepskin flying boots, three layers of gloves, silk, chamois, woolen. Half their items of clothing weren't even uniform at all. It gave some of them a raffish, almost piratical air, rather offset by the way they waddled around as if in nappies. Then they added even more, the Mae West, the parachute harness, until walking itself became difficult. Checked there was a whistle on their collars, dog tags round their necks. Then from the WAF orderlies, they collected their flasks of coffee, sandwiches, boiled sweets, chewing gum, fries, chocolate. They were given their escape kits, silk maps printed on scarves or handkerchiefs for the countries they were flying over, local money, compasses concealed in pens and buttons, phrase sheets. Teddy had kept a scrap of paper left over from a long raid to Chemnitz when it was feared that if they came down, they might be picked up by Russians, who wouldn't know what to make of them and would shoot them while they were making up their minds. It said, apparently, "I am an Englishman." They picked up their parachutes, and a pretty WAF gave Teddy a silk neck scarf and said shyly,
"Take that for me, will you, sir? Then I can say it's flown over Germany and bombed the enemy."
It smelt sweet.
"April violets," she said.
Like a knight taking a favour from some fair damsel in a tale of chivalry, he thought, and stuffed it in his pocket. He never saw it again. It must have fallen out at some point. The time for tales of chivalry was long over. They emptied their pockets of everything that might identify them. It was an act that always seemed symbolic to Teddy, crossing the threshold between being individuals and becoming flyers, anonymous, interchangeable. Englishmen, and Aussies, and Kiwis, and Canucks, Indians, West Indians, South Africans, Poles, French, Czechs, Rhodesians, Norwegians. The Yanks. In fact, the whole of Western civilization was ranged against Germany. You had to wonder how that could have happened to the country of Beethoven and Bach, and how they would feel about it if they had an afterward. Alle Menschen werden Brüder. Ursula's question. Do you think it's possible? One day? No, he didn't. Not really. A WAF stood at the door of the crew room and called for F. Fox and L. London's crews, and they all piled aboard the old charabang she was driving. Sometimes transport seemed as haphazard as some of their clothing. Lucky had been left in the arms of a particularly attractive WAF, an RT girl called Stella. He liked Stella, thought there might be something between them. Last week, Teddy had escorted her to a dance in the mess at a neighbouring station. A peck on the cheek on their return and a,
"Thank you, sir. That was jolly good fun."
Nothing more. There had been a sickening incident the day before at their own airfield. A WAF who had been decapitated by a propeller blade. Teddy shied away from remembering it, even now. It had left everyone somber, particularly, naturally, the WAFs. Stella was a good sort, like dogs and horses. Sometimes the awfulness of war led to sex, at other times it didn't. It was hard to fathom a reason for the different outcomes. He regretted not going to bed with Stella, and wondered if she felt the same. He had had a short-lived, very short-lived affair with a friend of Stella's called Julia. It had involved a lot of sex, very good sex, a secret memory. They reached F. Fox at dispersal and dismounted from the bus. Even at this point, Teddy was expecting the red light that would tell them that the raid had been scrubbed. But apparently this was not to be, so he carried on, going over the aircraft with the new pilot, the flight engineer, and the ground crew. The engineer was called Roy, Teddy reminded himself. The mid-upper was a Canadian called Joe. The tail-end Charlie was, helpfully, called Charlie. He looked about 12 years old. The tail gunner's perspex was getting a final polish with the blackouts. Teddy offered cigarettes all round. Only the bomb aimer didn't smoke.
Clifford,
he reminded Teddy when he could see him struggling.
Clifford,
Teddy murmured. All of the ground crew smoked like chimneys. Teddy wished that he could take them up on a raid, a safe one from which they would all be guaranteed to return. It seemed a shame that they never experienced what their aircraft went through, never saw the view through that well-polished perspex. At the end of the war, the RAF did Cook's tours, flying the earthbound personnel over Germany so they could see the havoc that they had helped to wreak. Ursula managed to wangle her way onto one. Teddy had no idea how, but he wasn't surprised. The war had proved his sister to be rather good at negotiating the great game of bureaucracy. It was terrible, she reported, to see a country in total ruin. Teddy Sproggs all urinated on the wheel of F. Fox, and then looked slightly abashed when they realized that Teddy wasn't going to partake of this masculine ritual. He was their sadhu, Teddy thought, a guru. He could have told them to climb up to the control tower roof and throw themselves off in an orderly sequence, and they would have done. He sighed and fumbled with his enormous amount of clothing and took an unnecessary piss against the wheel. The Sproggs gave each other covert grins of relief. Then the ground crew made their usual unshowy, optimistic farewells, shaking hands all round.
Good luck. See you in the morning.
Teddy stood next to the pilot for takeoff. The pilot was called Fraser, from Edinburgh, a student at St. Andrews. A different kind of Scot from Kenny Nielsen. No second Dickie flight for him. Instead, his wing commander, riding shotgun. He remembered the crew of W. William. This aircraft took off at 16:20 hours and failed to return. It has therefore been reported as missing. The Bristol Hercules engines whined as the propellers made their first few jerky revolutions before catching and turning to the familiar staccato. Good engines, Teddy told Fraser when they were doing their checks. Fraser, of necessity, was interested in the mechanics of bombing. Port outer, port inner, followed by starboard inner, starboard outer. Once all the checks were done, the mag drops and oil pressures and so on, Fraser asked control for permission to taxi. He glanced at Teddy, as if he needed his approval more than he needed the control towers, and Teddy gave him a thumbs up. The chocks were removed, and they edged forward to join the procession on the perimeter track, the engines throbbing and rumbling, a vibration that passed through muscle into bone and lodged in the heart and lungs. There was something magnificent about it, to Teddy's mind. They were fifth in line to take off, and they swung onto the runway, engines to full boost, waiting, a greyhound in a trap, ready to go when the controller's Aldis light showed green. Teddy was still expecting the red light from the control tower cancelling the op. It never came. Sometimes they were even recalled once they were in the air. Not this time. The usual flare-path farewell party had gathered at the controller's caravan. Assorted WAFs, cookhouse and ground crew. The CO was there, the Air Vice Marshal too, saluting every aircraft as it passed. Those who are about to die do not salute you back, Teddy thought. Instead, he gave a thumbs up to Stella, who was also there, holding Lucky in her arms. And as they rolled down the runway, she lifted one of the dog's paws and waved it. Better than any scrambled egg salute in Teddy's book. He laughed, and Fraser glanced at him in alarm. Taking off was a serious business, especially when it was your first operational sortie, and your wing commander was your second pilot. And that same Winko was showing signs of eccentric behaviour. The green light showed, and they began to lumber along the runway like an overweight bird, trying to reach the necessary 105 mph that would unstick 12 tons of metal and petrol and explosive from the earth. Teddy helped with the engine throttles and felt the usual relief as Fraser eased back on the yoke and F. Fox strained to drag herself off the ground. Unconsciously, Teddy touched the little silver hair in his breast pocket. They roared towards the farmhouse, and Teddy looked for the farmer's daughter, but could see no sign of her. He felt a chill. She was always there. He could see the flat fields in the dusk, the bare brown earth, the darkening horizon, the farmhouse, the farmyard. They banked and began to circle, stacking and gathering themselves before heading for the coast, and as F. Fox's wing dipped to port, he caught sight of her. She was gazing up at them, waving blindly, waving at them all. They were safe. He waved back, although he knew she couldn't see him. The squadrons in the north had to take off an hour earlier than those on the more southerly airfields, and then had to fly due south to meet at the rendezvous point. It gave them some relatively safe time to get on with their routine tasks. Once they were in the air, there were no idle moments. All that gloomy introspection that could take hold on the ground disappeared. The flight engineer was kept busy synchronizing the engines, calculating fuel stocks, changing petrol tanks. The IFF was switched on to identify them as friend rather than foe to the RAF's own fighters. The Spark wound out the trailing wireless aerial, and the navigator put his head down, working on accurate fixes, comparing the actual winds to those forecast. Once they were over the sea, the bomb aimer started chucking window out. They were still flying with their navigation lights on, and Teddy could see the red and green lights twinkling on the wingtips of other aircraft. They ground their way over the North Sea, climbing all the time. The waves were highlighted by the moon, and the wings of F. Fox glinted like polished silver. They may as well have had a searchlight shining on them. The gunners tested their Brownings in short bursts over the sea. The bombs were fused, the navigation light switched off. At 5,000 feet, they put their oxygen masks on, and Teddy heard the familiar rasping breathing over the intercom. They were bowled across Belgium by a following wind. Visibility was so good that they could see many of the other aircraft in the bomber stream. It was as close to a daylight raid as Teddy had ever been. His life took place at night. The wide-awake moon could be seen reflected in lakes and rivers as they passed over them, escorting them mile after spotlit mile. There's not a trace upon her face of diffidence or shyness. Hugh had loved his Gilbert and Sullivan gramophone records. There had been an amateur performance of the Mikado put on in the local village hall, and their father had astonished them all by taking the role of Coco, the Lord High Executioner. He had relished the complete change of character it had afforded him, leering and prancing and singing around the stage. "Quite the Jekyll and Hyde," Sylvie said. Mrs. Shawcross had played Katisha. Again, another thespian revelation. They reached the first turning point near Charleroi, and not long after that, the slaughter began. There were fighters everywhere, like angry wasps whose nests had been disturbed. It was a shock to meet them so early, and so many of them. Not a nest that had been disturbed, but a swarm that seemed to have been waiting for them. "I can see an aircraft going down in flames off the port bow," the mid-upper gunner reported.
"Log that, navigator," Fraser said.
"Okay, skipper."
The rear gunner's voice this time.
"One going down on the starboard beam." "Log that, navigator."
Teddy, standing next to Fraser, could see stricken aircraft everywhere. The sky was scattered with the bright white stars of explosions.
"Are they scarecrows, sir?"
the bomb aimer asked. Fraser was skipper, Teddy noticed, and the crew had plumped for sir for Teddy so as not to confuse them with each other. They had all heard the rumour that the Germans were using scarecrows, anti-aircraft shells simulating exploding bombers, but it had always seemed unlikely to Teddy. He saw some of the bright white stars belching the dirty, oily red flames that were only too familiar to him. His Sprog crew had never seen a bomber shot down until now. Baptism of fire, he thought. Some floated down like large leaves, others plummeted straight to the earth. A fellow Halifax over on their port beam flew past with all four engines on fire, spilling streams of burning petrol, but too far away to see if there were any crew aboard. Suddenly its wings collapsed like a drop-leaf table, and it fell from the sky like a dead bird.
"Not scarecrows, aircraft, I'm afraid," he said, and heard several gasps of horror on the intercom. Perhaps he should have let them continue with their delusions. Aircraft everywhere were going down on fire or exploding, often with no sign that they even knew they had been attacked. The mid-upper continued to count them, and the navigator to tick them in his log, until Teddy intervened and said, "That's enough," because he could tell from their breathing that the crew were beginning to panic. On their port beam, an aircraft on fire from aft to stern flew by, straight and level, but upside down. Teddy saw a Lancaster erupt in sheets of white flame and drop onto a Halifax below it. Both went cartwheeling down to earth together, gigantic pinwheels of fire. Teddy could see what must be a Pathfinder spooling down to earth, its red and green marker flares exploding prettily as it hit the ground. He had never been a witness to this much carnage. Aircraft went down in the distance usually, stars flaring and dying. Crews simply disappeared. They weren't there next morning for their bacon and eggs. You didn't give too much thought to how they disappeared. The horror and terror of those last moments were hidden. Now they were inescapable. The Pathfinder puzzled Teddy. It should be at the head of the main force. Either it was in the wrong place, or they were. He asked the navigator to check the winds again. It seemed to Teddy that they had drifted north of that red ribbon. He sensed the confusion in the navigator's reply. He found himself wishing for Mac's experience. Down below he could see the blazing wreckage of aircraft on the ground stretching back for 50 or 60 miles. Then, as further proof of the scarecrow myth, over on the starboard beam, they saw a Lancaster, illuminated by the cruel moon. It may as well have been coned by a searchlight, being stalked stealthily by a German fighter from underneath, invisible to her oblivious rear gunner. The fighter had an upward-pointing cannon, the first Teddy had ever seen. Of course, that was why so many aircraft were going down so suddenly. The cannon looked as though they were pointing straight into the vulnerable bellies of the bombers. But if they could hit the wings where the fuel tanks were, then the bombers didn't stand a chance. He watched helplessly as the fighter opened fire before peeling quickly away from its victim. The Lancaster's wings exploded into great gouts of white fire, and F. Fox lurched violently. Before they had a chance to recover, they were raked by cannon fire, ripping and clattering along the flimsy aluminium fuselage, and without warning they pitched into a vertical dive. Teddy thought that Fraser must be trying to evade the fighter, but when he glanced at him, he saw to his horror that he was slumped over the controls. There was no sign of any injury. He could have been asleep, for all Teddy could tell. He shouted for help over the intercom. It was almost impossible to get at the controls with Fraser in this position, and he had to try to hold his inert body back and at the same time haul back on the controls, while the G-force was like a ton of concrete on his head. Both the Spark and the engineer fought their way forward and started tussling with the motionless Fraser. The pilot seat was quite high up in the aircraft, and it was a snug fit to cram yourself into it with all your kit on. To extricate someone from that position seemed like a near impossible task, especially as Teddy was perched on the edge of the seat, and at one point he thought he might have to crouch on poor Fraser's lap. Somehow or other they wrestled the pilot out, and Teddy took his seat. There was no blood anywhere, for which he was grateful. They were screaming earthward at 300 mph now, F. Fox almost standing on her head. Teddy yelled for the flight engineer, and they both wrapped themselves around the yoke and hung onto it for dear life. Teddy worried that the wings would simply be pulled off, but finally, after what seemed like an eternity, but must have been a handful of seconds, their combined strength was just enough to actuate the elevators and bring the nose back up again, and they leveled out and started a ponderous climb back up. There were a lot of expletives on the intercom, and Teddy did a crew check and told them rather tersely,
The pilot's been hit, I'm afraid. I'm taking over. Navigator, plot a new course for the target, please. The gods alone knew where they were now, and possibly not even them. The Spark and the flight engineer had dragged Fraser to the crew rest position. Still breathing, Skipper, the Spark reported. He was no longer Sir, he noticed. He was the Skipper. The Captain. Dismayed muttering from the bomb aimer alerted Teddy to something he had never seen before. Vapor trails. They were never usually seen below 25,000 feet, and now they were everywhere, pouring from the tails of the bombers. The contrails were bright banners, marking them as targets even more clearly than the moon, if that was possible. The bomber stream had long ago begun to disintegrate. The more experienced pilots had realized that rather than being the safest place to be, it had become the most dangerous. Teddy began to elbow his way out to the edge of it at the same time as he pushed higher. Keep a tight bomber stream. Always. His last command to his squadron. He hoped they weren't blindly following his instructions. Teddy was working the sky as much as he could. Air Fox couldn't quite make the height of the Lancasters, but in the thin air and with good engines, he got pretty close. Nonetheless, they were spotted. One coming in, Skipper.
Okay, Navigator. 900 feet, 800.
The Navigator counted off the distance of the approaching blip on his radar screen. 700.
600.
See anything yet, Gunners?
No, Skipper.
From both.
500. 400.
Got him, Skipper.
From the mid-upper gunner.
Port up a quarter. Corkscrew port. Go, go, go!
Up the revs, engineer. 100 on, Skip.
Hang on, everybody,
Teddy said, as he rammed the controls forward, rolling the aircraft and dropping the wing down to port. The G-force pinned him to his seat. They spun down, the altimeter unwinding until, at the bottom of the dive, he rolled the aircraft to starboard, pulled the ailerons back, and they lumbered upwards again. He was trying to find cloud to hide in, but the mid-upper was shouting,
Starboard upper quarter! Corkscrew starboard! Go, go, go!
Sometimes the amount of turbulence alone that was created was enough to put a fighter off, but not this one. As soon as they had climbed again, there was a shout from the rear gunner,
Bandit at rear port! Dive to port!
The gunner's Brownings were drumming away and the aircraft filled with the stink of cordite. The sky around F-Fox was crowded with bullet and cannon tracer. Teddy threw the heavy aircraft around in the sky, dropping into a starboard dive and then heeling into a port curve, clawing his way back up the sky, trying to shake the fighter off their shoulder. He felt exhausted from the sheer physical effort needed to control the aircraft. Needs must, he heard his mother say. The gunners were out of ammunition, but then the mid-upper reported,
Port Bandit broken away, Skipper.
And then,
Starboard Bandit moved on too, Skipper.
On to another poor sod, Teddy thought, and said,
Well done, Gunners.
Their luck finally ran out. They never reached the target. Teddy wasn't sure they would ever have found it anyway. Many didn't, he learned later. It happened very quickly. 1 minute they were in the dark void of the sky, no sign of the bomber stream anymore, and the next they were coned and were being hit by flak. Huge, hollow bangs as if the fuselage was being battered by a sledgehammer. They must have found the Ruhr's defences. Dazzled and blinded by the searchlights, all Teddy could do was fling the aircraft into another dive. He could feel poor F. Fox protesting. He had already tested her beyond her limits, and he was expecting her to break up any second. He suspected that he, too, had been tested beyond his limits. But suddenly they were out of the awful light and back into the welcome dark. The port wing was on fire and they were rapidly losing height. Teddy knew instinctively that there was going to be no soft landing this time, no ditching, no WAF guiding them into a friendly airfield. F. Fox was going to her death. He gave the order to abandon the aircraft. The navigator kicked off the escape hatch, and he and the Spark strapped a parachute onto the injured pilot and pushed him out. The Spark followed quickly, then the navigator.
The mid-upper climbed down from his turret and followed. The rear gunner reported that his turret was shot up, and he couldn't get it to revolve. The bomb-aimer crawled up from the nose, fighting gravity, and went to see if he could help the rear gunner manually release the turret. Flames had begun to lick the inside of the fuselage. They had come out of the dive, but were still losing height. Teddy was expecting F. Fox to explode at any moment. There was no word from the bomb-aimer or the rear gunner. Clifford and Charlie. Their names suddenly came back to him. He was fighting F. Fox now, trying to keep her flying straight and level. Clifford appeared by his side and said the fire had prevented him from getting to the rear gunner, and Teddy told him to jump. He disappeared through the hatch. It was all a blur after that. There was a curtain of flames behind him. He could feel them beginning to scorch his seat. The intercom was no longer working, but he carried on wrestling with F. Fox to give the rear gunner a last-ditch chance to get out. The captain was always the last to leave. And then, when he thought he was resigned to death, quite accepting of it, the instinct for life kicked in, and the jaws of death were forced open. He found himself tearing off the twin umbilicals of oxygen and intercom, and flinging himself out of his seat, and was more or less sucked from F. Fox's belly through the escape hatch. The silence of the night sky was stunning after the noise inside the aircraft. He was alone, floating in the dark, the great, peaceful dark. The moon was shining benignly on him. Below, a river ran like silver. Germany laid out like a map in the moonlight, growing closer and closer as he drifted towards it like a feathery dandelion head. Above him, the fiery form of F. Fox continued to glide on her downward path. Teddy wondered if the rear gunner was still inside. He shouldn't have abandoned him. The aircraft found the ground before Teddy did, and he watched as it exploded in a glittering starburst of light. He would live, he realized. There would be an afterward, after all. He gave thanks to whichever god had stepped in to save him. 2012. All the Way to Bright.
Geofencing.
We should want to do because...
The new normal. Client-agency relationship, or on the other hand, as well as near-field communication.
The man who was speaking had a degree in jargon and a doctorate in nonsense. His words were floating in the air, language devoid of meaning, sucking out the oxygen, making Bertie feel mildly hypoxic. The man speaking, the nonsense man, as she thought of him, was called Angus and came from Scottish stock, hence the name, although his accent was pure English public school.
Harrow, actually.
And Bertie knew these things because she had been on a date with him, a date procured by that well-known panda, Match.com, which was why she was now slouched at the back of the room, trying to look as if she wasn't there. She had taken an almost instant dislike to him over a dinner at Nopi, which, when the bill arrived, he had been more than happy to go Dutch on, thereby failing one of her first requirements of a suitor, which was to behave like a gentleman. She wanted doors opening, meals paid for, flowers, billet doux. Lovely words made her think of doves, bill and coo. She wanted to be courted, gallantry. What a lovely word. Fat chance of any of that. She snorted to herself, and the man seated next to her in the industry seminar gave her a nervous glance.
Bertie,
the nonsense man had said over dinner.
What kind of name is that?
A very good one. And after a long, rather tedious silence,
Roberta, after my grandmother.
Roberta was Bertie's middle name. She wasn't about to give Angus the moon. Just the wrong side of sensible, she had gone home with him, classic mistake, to his flat in Battersea, a flat which was all shiny glass surfaces, as if it had been designed in the future, and then she had proceeded to have rather disagreeable, drunken sex with him, which, naturally, had led to self-loathing and a stealthy dawn exit.